It's the 17th of May 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. If Michael Gove were a literary figure, would he be Mr. Wrong or Mr. Nonsense? If government ministers use PR surveys to form policy, should we worry about George Osborne playing for double money in round two? When old people moan about kids not reading the classics, are they serious or is that just an allegory for despair? And how long does it take to map the cosmic genome? But before we begin, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really appreciate all the donations as they help us pay the server bills and that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now we start the show this week with the Education Secretary, Michael Gove. No, don't switch off. He's been talking some rubbish this week, and it's important that we teach him a lesson. We've got three pieces about him this week, and I know that sounds like a lot. That's because, listeners, we Gove you. That works better written down, you know, think about it. But why are we talking about Michael Gove? Especially when we could be memorising facts about him by rote instead. Well, this week, in a big speech, he attacked history teachers, and in particular, an exercise suggested on the website of teacher Russell Tarr, which suggested using Mr. Men characters to explain the Nazis to GCSE students. Or at least, that's what Michael Gove claimed. Unfortunately, that's not quite the case. So we're starting this week by going to the original source, critically examining it from different angles, and learning analytical skills in the process. You know, a bit like in a history lesson. So to start, here's me speaking to Russell earlier this week to find out exactly what happened. I started by asking him exactly what the Mr. Men exercise was all about.
Well, the way I was actually using it was that it was at the end of a very detailed six-week study unit with Year 10s, which are 14 to 15-year-old students, and they'd been studying the rise of Hitler, the collapse of the Weimar Republic and democracy in Germany, in other words. They produced a coursework essay on that of 1,000 words. They were examined in the final examination just a few days ago on that topic as well. So it's a very complex, very detailed story, very important one. Mm. And at the very end of it, they were required to produce a children's storybook of the same event. And the whole idea is it's a revision activity, it's a recap activity, and it forces them to reduce a very complex historical phenomenon down to its bare essentials, which is a very challenging exercise. And then we took it across to the local primary school, and we read it to a bunch of those students, or a series of those stories, different groups of those students. And those students could then ask questions about what was really being represented, what the metaphors meant, and so on.
Oh, well, that sounds fascinating. So what was the actual practical examples of this?
Well, we take as the starting point. We asked them, you know, if Weimar Germany itself was a Mr. Man, how would you describe it? What Mr. Men would you choose? And some of them would say, well, the cause for its downfall was that it was too idealistic. You know, it wanted too much too soon from a country which was used to authoritarian rule. So it becomes Mr. Daydream. So this is like almost like a structuralist argument that it was always destined to collapse. Whereas other students said, well, no, I think it simply made a series of mistakes, a series of errors which could have been avoided. And they might then choose Mr. Wrong, or, and so on and so forth. Or they didn't increase unemployment benefits during the Depression, so they become Mr. Mean. And if you start from that premise, it's then, okay, if you're taking that as your starting point, how then would you describe Hitler? What character would he be? You know, was he a man who had great vision and ideas, in which case you choose one character, or did he simply exploit the weaknesses of the Weimar Republic, in which case it becomes Mr. Mischief, and so on and so forth. You have different characters, you have different themes. The whole story starts to evolve, but the metaphor becomes very sophisticated.
Obviously, I imagine the last few days have been, you know, rather busy and strange for you. I mean, what's the reaction to this been like?
Well, the reaction's been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, I'll say overwhelmingly, I've said 99.9% positive. I kind of picked up the story as I was just arriving at my holiday destination with my family, and Mr. Gove was still making his speech where he's holding my sign and my activities up for ridicule at Brighton whilst I was receiving the calls. You know, I was getting the calls as the speech was still being made, and I was being asked for my immediate reaction. I didn't have any context to put it in. So I quickly checked my email, and lots of people were saying, you know, don't let him get you down. Don't take this not personally. The man's just talking nonsense. He's got no experience. He's just quoting from sources and listening to people who don't really know what they're talking about or don't represent the profession as a whole. But I can't say I've at any moment felt threatened or downcast about it, because I only had to read his speech to realise he was talking absolute rubbish.
I guess the fact that you mentioned that you looking for context sets you apart from Gove, who would probably prefer if you know, who would just be looking for a series of dates.
Well, I mean, that's his approach to history. And one of the misconceptions and the annoying and frustrating things, really, is that I think most history teachers would agree with Mr. Gove that dates, names, places, chronology are absolutely central to any understanding of history. There is no difference of opinion there at all. I think where the difference of opinion is that he sees that as the be-all and end-all of history teaching. You learn your series of dates, your names, your kings, your queens, the great figures in history, if you like, a very great man theory of history, we call it, a very 19th century sort of an approach, and then that's the end of it. Whereas modern history teaching is you take that very much as a starting point only. It's very important, you've got to have that. But then it's all about, well, what do you make of those events? You know, why did World War One happen? You know, just learn the series of events leading up to it, you know, and then this happened, and then this, and then this, and then this. Because if you do that, what's the point? That is what's called your pub quiz knowledge. So instead, it's, well, who was to blame? Why did it happen? What were the big forces at work? You know, what could Nazism have happened somewhere else? Can democracy still fail in various countries? Why did dictators emerge? I mean, we grapple with these big questions in the classroom, which are of a much higher intellectual order, ironically, than what Mr. Gove is proposing in his supposed quest for an increase in academic standards.
Is it that there's, say, you and Michael Gove want different outcomes? Is it different priorities in terms of what you people want to get out of the history, say? Would Michael Gove's approach be about creating the national myth, say, and creating the whole sort of Great Britain sense of place and nationalism, whereas I guess your approach would be more about giving kids analytical skills and that sort of thing?
Well, this has been a false dichotomy. I mean, I even heard on the BBC radio programme, or the Moral Maze, just a few weeks ago, I think the most recent Moral Maze episode was about the future of history teaching, and I was sort of screaming at the radio as I was listening to it, because there seems to be, they constructed this important, is it the knowledge and the body of facts, or is it the interpretation? Do you have A or do you have B? And I'd say, well, why are they mutually exclusive? You can't have an interpretation without knowledge, and you need the knowledge to form an interpretation. So the idea that you can only have one or the other is nonsense, but what Mr. Gove is doing is just wants to cram in more and more and more facts and dates and places that students need to know about without establishing why they need to know them. And that kind of takes all of the interest and the sense of discovery and evolution of points of view that make history such an engaging subject for youngsters today.
At what point do you think, I mean, speaking as a teacher, do you think kids should be introduced to the idea of sort of these competing, you know, historical narratives and historical theory and so on?
As soon as they start, this idea that young students, you know, kids who are five or six, probably a little bit young, they just need a bedrock there. But my daughter's currently 10 years old, so she's currently in year six. And when she was in year five last year, she had an exercise with me where my year eight students, who are about 13 years old, had produced books about Henry VIII as the end of their studies. Half of the class had deliberately produced books suggesting that Henry was a really evil guy. And they're getting used to that sort of emotive, biased, persuasive style of writing and cherry-picking the evidence appropriately. The other half of the class did the opposite. So we had two competing views of Henry VIII. The students in that class, who were like 9 years old, 9, 10 years old at most, they then had those stories read to them, one on the positive side, one on the negative side, and then had to pick apart, so which one's telling the truth? And the point is, well, both of them are telling the truth. We're dealing with a real person here, so the good sides and bad sides. And they had to rate him as a husband, as a ruler, as a father, as a friend. And they stood along the continuum line and so on. So these sorts of exercises are really good fun. We're out there on the school field kind of arranging ourselves along in a line. They're 9 years old, and they're dealing with complex questions of historical interpretation, but at the very same time learning the facts about Henry VIII, who he was, what he stood for, what he did. So I hope you can appreciate my frustration when you hear these debates about what's more important, the interpretations or the facts. You can teach the facts through interpretation, the interpretation through facts. They go hand in hand.
Is it a relatively new thing in history teaching, or is it of increased importance in say, more recent times?
I mean, I don't put myself out there as any great educationalist or pedagogic expert or anything like that. I just work with students, and I've been teaching for 16 solid years, so I just know what works in the classroom. And what I know is that you mix things up, you try different techniques. But in direct answer to your question, I think I'm correct to say that this was very much an initiative of the 70s and the School History Project, which is still highly influential, very well respected, and they do an annual conference, which I'm lucky enough to be attending this year as well, up in Leeds. And they came up with this idea of skills and a source-based approach to history teaching, trying to break away from simply drilling into students facts and knowledge for its own sake.
I think we should leave it there. It's been fascinating talking to you, Russell, about all these different techniques. Thank you very
Great.
Much.
Thank you very much.
So there we have it. Whilst we may remember Martin Luther King for I Have a Dream and Lincoln for the Gettysburg Address, maybe we'll remember Michael Gove for misreporting the Mr. Men. A bit later on in the same speech, Michael Gove slags off what the kids today read. Apparently they don't choose the classics. Which, yes, may be a bit elitist, but I think he has a point. It's a bit like coalition politics. Whilst I guess some people may like the lowbrow stuff that Nick Clegg, for example, comes out with now, I prefer to read it in the original Lib Dem manifesto version. Sure, there's some problematic language for today's modern sensibilities, but it really feels more authentic. I think Sean Ellis might agree with me. And in this next piece, he gives us his take on Gove's approach to literature.
Way back in episode 94, I talked about the subjectivity of entertainment and how it's okay to like Michael McIntyre or Kylie Minogue or whatever. So, now, to add more gasoline to this particular fire, along comes Michael Gove, lamenting that today's teens like to read Twilight rather than Middlemarch. Well, surprise. Double dose of sarcasm here. One, that Mary Ann Stevens's novel from 1870 might not resonate with the majority of teenagers in 2013. And two, that the thought processes of Michael Gove might not resonate with the majority of teenagers in 2013. To just dismiss this as, oh, well, it's something Gove said, so it must be false, would be oh so tempting, but lazy. Although I must admit that if he said the sky was blue, I'd be hiring a colorimeter just to check. Before I get going, let it be said, I love reading. I'm rarely more than a few feet away from a book, and usually have a mix of fact and fiction on the go at any one time. My bedside table is mostly hidden under piles of books in various states of redness. Some books I'll read many times, as I love the setting, the characters, the writing, and above all, the ideas within them. And yet, when I was at school, English literature was my least favourite and least successful subject. My lowest ever exam score, 14%, was on an English literature paper. Why? Because of the selection of books we were supposed to read. There were a few that stood out as interesting. The Cave was an adventure novel about a bunch of school kids exploring a cave. Animal Farm was an excellent introduction to allegory. And the inclusion of E.M. Forster's short story The Machine Stops was the only thing that saved me from abject failure in my O-level. Macbeth was quite good too. Murder, ghosts, psychosis. But the worst for me though, the things I simply did not engage with at any level, with a bread and butter of the English Lit O-level. Historical fiction. Robert Hardy is, I'm sure, an excellent and accomplished writer, and I do recall the occasional piece of description as being particularly well done, but the plot of The Woodlanders was summed up by a friend of mine at the time as, nothing happens, and I heartily agreed with him. Moonfleet, I soldiered on manfully for weeks, until finally giving up, on page 9. We were largely spared Laurie Lee. Regrettably, I can't find a reference for this, but I do remember my stepmother referring to an interview with him. In it, he said that he regretted the popularity of Cider with Rosie as a set book for O-level, as it was not meant for children, and it put so many of them off his work for life. The idea of me, as a devout un-fan of historical fiction, being forced to read and critique Middlemarch is a form of little death, a squandering of time, interest, and enthusiasm. Now, I am unashamedly a science fiction fan. I like the ideas, the exploration of the possible and impossible, and the way it affects society and the people within it. Sure, to misquote Theodore Sturgeon, 90% of science fiction is crap. But then, 90% of everything is crap. Genre fiction was very much frowned upon in our school. I hope this has changed. I think that it has, otherwise Gove wouldn't have anything to rail against. When I won a school prize in the sixth form, I chose a couple of books of short stories by the award-winning author Larry Niven. This was behaviour so far beyond the pale that my English teacher shouted at me, and my housemaster lent me a book of satellite imagery to be presented with on the day. In direct contradiction of the predictions of my English teacher at the time, I still have those books, one of them now signed by Larry Niven himself, and the stories still move me today in a way that none of the so-called great literature we were set ever did. And this is my point. Books are works of fiction. They're meant as entertainment. Sometimes high concept, sometimes polemic, sometimes pure action, but entertainment nonetheless. If they don't work for you as entertainment, they don't work for you at all. This isn't intended to be a sweeping statement. I know there are loads of people out there who love Jane Austen and despise sci-fi with a passion. And that's my point. No one book will entertain everyone, and no one is entertained by everything. If you don't find a piece of literature entertaining, then dry over-analysis of it is a great way of sucking out the last possible scraps of enjoyment. Why did Shakespeare write this line? Because he was pandering to his audience, sir, and trying to gain favour with the king? No, Ellis, allegory. Are you sure, sir? Shakespeare is a poet. I got the best out of him when deliberately not stopping to analyse and translate, and just letting the words wash over me and immersing myself in his world. Having said that, careful, sympathetic analysis of something you do enjoy can be fruitful. It helps you appreciate it all the more. After university, I was lucky enough to attend a short course in creative writing under Brian Stableford, another noted SF author. Although it didn't transform me into the next Arthur C. Clarke overnight, or indeed at all, knowing how stories work and how to make a tale convincing has led me to enjoy the fiction I do like even more. One of the set books for that course was called How and Why 10 Science Fiction Stories Work, and I do recommend it to anyone who has an interest. However, and this is coming back to the meat of the point, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone who isn't already interested in the genre. It would be terribly, terribly dull. Reading should be first and foremost entertainment. If kids are getting by reading Twilight, or Middlemarch, or Percy Jackson, or Jane Austen, or Tracy Beaker, or Harry Potter, then let them. Their tastes will grow and develop, and they'll find their own way. I would have been much happier with English literature as an appreciation of the literature that we love, rather than an analysis of whatever is forced onto us as proper literature by the likes of Michael Gove. This is Sean Ellis, reading Permutation City again for the ninth time, for The Poddelusion.
Now, did you know that 98% of people think that Michael Gove is awful? Well, that's not true, as far as we know, but it could easily be the result of a PR-driven survey. This week, it was revealed by a series of Freedom of Information requests that Gove was making claims about kids' historical knowledge based on surveys carried out by, you guessed it, the TV channel UK Gold. Presumably, we can expect to see Del Boy falling through a bar on the curriculum sometime soon. To explain more, here's Marsh.
As Poddelusion listeners are doubtlessly aware, Education Secretary Michael Gove was roundly and correctly ridiculed this week after it emerged his criticisms of school children's English history knowledge was based on PR research carried out by Premier Inn and UK TV Gold. While the irony of a man looking to improve educational standards in history being himself unable to spot a compromised source is one which hasn't escaped the attention of commentators, oddly little spotlight was shone on the source of the dodgy data itself. Ludicrous as it is that a senior politician in a position of power could be so embarrassingly unfamiliar with acceptable standards of research, it seems remiss not to question why marketing-led data ended up in a position to be taken seriously in the first place. The reason no questions have been raised might conceivably be due to a degree of embarrassment, given that the primary conduit for PR puff pieces is the mainstream media itself. Take The Telegraph, who pulled no punches in deconstructing Gove's embarrassing error, despite themselves having recently published research from B&Q highlighting the annoyance of neighbours mowing their lawns in the morning. Similarly, the BBC, who also ran an account of Gove's cock-up, only last week published a press release from pen manufacturers BIC declaring, in the run-up to exam season, naturally, that students should rely less on their lucky underwear and instead follow advice to revise diligently and pack a spare pen. And perhaps most red-faced of all ought to be The Independent, who reported merely a week ago that we lazy Brits don't do enough walking, with research commissioned by the Ramblers Association. The paper reported the hapless Education Secretary's reliance on PR surveys, despite having themselves published one of the very PR surveys they criticised Gove for citing. Perhaps someone at The Independent needs to be reminded what they say about having your cake and eating it. The Daily Mail, perhaps most wisely, have yet to criticise Gove. Smart, given that they previously published each of the PR surveys he cited, and especially considering that in last week alone they've published more than 22 articles derived from the same questionable opinion poll mould. While the error from the Education Secretary was cringeworthy and troubling, there's a degree of hypocrisy in the news media criticising Gove for believing what they, presumably at the time, felt was worthwhile enough to print. The ease with which PR surveys pass into the mainstream media, and into the eager hands of education secretaries, it seems, would be less concerning if the research they presented was of a high standard. Unfortunately, for the majority of such opinion polls, commercial interest and crippling methodological flaws often render the results completely worthless. Take, for example, three of the surveys cited by Gove, whose original press releases can be easily located. All three polls were conducted by polling company OnePoll, a prolific operator in the online opinion poll industry. It was OnePoll who recently informed us that women hate their bodies more than ever, in a survey sponsored by a dieting company, that women can't manage money as well as men, according to a cashback website, and that men should be less lazy when it comes to doing DIY, says an entirely impartial DIY retailer. There's no shortage of OnePoll surveys in the news each week, yet, on examination, serious questions can be raised over their gathering of data. OnePoll claimed to have a community of over 100,000 users, with users paid around 10 pence for every survey they complete, with surveys regularly consisting of over a dozen questions. As money spinners go, it's hardly lucrative. What's more, users can only collect their earnings after accruing £40, equating to roughly 300 surveys and potentially hundreds of hours. This low return on investment becomes an incentive to undertake as many polls as possible. And with limits on the number of users able to complete each survey, users are soon tempted to spend no time at all thinking honestly about their answers. If only the first 2,000 people can earn 10 pence for their 10 minutes of work, why should you be the person who lingers too long and finds they have wasted their time for no reward at all? This, combined with the ease of second-guessing the desired answer to screening questions... Why, yes, I do have children under the age of 7. It almost certainly results in some polls being completed by users who've got no relationship to the subject matter and have no concern for the answers they're providing. The problems don't even stop there. Ask any psychology student and they'll tell you any answer you receive depends entirely on the question you ask and the way in which you ask it. Take, for instance, a question posed by OnePoll to new mothers this week. Do you find you don't actually care as much about your appearance now that you've had a baby? You can answer, yes, absolutely. No, I care, I just don't have the time to do anything about it. Or neither. Once you pick your way through the positives and the negatives there, it's clear that both of the first two options, while they look like they're yes and no, they're actually both presuming that new mothers don't take care of their appearance. This may or may not be true, but it's not a finding which the question solicits. Yet it would be completely easy for a PR firm, perhaps acting on behalf of a cosmetics or a clothing retailer, to spin an article just as well from either of those two responses just based on this one question alone. Similarly, multiple choice questions can often force users into making fairly clumsy, sweeping generalisations, such as a question posed to male users of OnePoll earlier this year. It read, "Please be brutally honest. Whose cooking do you think is better, your mum's or your wife's or partner's?" Heaven help the men who are faced with that 50-50 choice between choosing their mum or choosing their partner or their wife. There's no third option of neither. Yet, with a shiny 10 pence on the line and no other options available, a choice has to be made. And thus, as the Daily Mail declared a fortnight later, over half of British men think their mums are better cooks than their partners. Somewhat lost in that article, in that write-up, is that the men in question were forced into a choice, a 50-50 choice at that, and only marginally more than half opted for the first option that they found on the list, that of their mum. The lack of transparency of survey method and the availability of actual data in the final write-up is a further issue with PR polls, and it brings us very neatly back to those polls cited by Gove. Take the finding, highlighted as the very headline of both the original press release and the Daily Mail article, that Delia Smith was married to Henry VIII. Reading the entire article in the press release, nowhere is it reported how many of the 2,000 children to take the poll actually picked Delia Smith as a response. It's perfectly plausible, if not highly likely, that the main headline and the main angle of the news coverage of this story was actually generated by only a handful of respondents choosing this rather silly option, perhaps intentionally for a laugh, perhaps unknowingly, or perhaps because they're rushing through surveys as fast as they can and not caring about the information they provide. It's equally likely, too, that the survey wasn't actually of 2,000 11 to 16-year-olds, but of 2,000 people who said yes to the screening question, do you have a child aged 11 to 16-year-old with you right now taking this survey? They may not have been telling the truth. Those screening questions are, after all, not rocket science to figure out, and users are incentivized to take as many surveys as they can, as quickly as they can. They don't care about the final data. That's not their concern. So, most intriguing of all, then, is the possibility, summing all of this up, that the Education Secretary criticised the ignorance of children in this country based on a number of newspaper reports of a small minority of errant and silly responses given to a PR opinion poll by people who weren't actually even children. Until there's real transparency on the data and better control over the survey methodology, there's no real way of knowing whether this is true or not. This survey isn't unique in that respect. There are dozens of similar cases featured in the news each week, often with significant potential flaws. The only unique thing about this survey was that it was used to justify the changing of an educational policy of history. As for Michael Gove, he ought to be more cautious about believing what he reads in the newspapers and should learn to be more sceptical of his sources. Those who don't learn history are doomed to ignorantly repeat things. This has been Michael Marshall, taking great care to check his sources for the Pod Delusion.
Now, as we mentioned a few weeks ago, the long campaign to reform the libel laws achieved victory as the Defamation Bill was passed and became the Defamation Act. We've covered the details on the new laws extensively in the past. Suffice to say, it's some pretty good news. And last night, Sense About Science, the organisation who pushed libel reform, held a big old do at the Pendrell's Oak Pub in London, the location of the first meeting that 4 years ago started them on the journey. It was a celebratory evening, and many of the big-name supporters were there. And here's some clips of what they had to say.
There's a whole range of people who said kind words about Sense About Science, Simon Singh, and all those who supported libel reform over the last 4 years. We can't fit them all into this podcast, but safe to say, it was a rather jovial night. First up is Dave Gorman, giving credit where credit is due. Sort of.
It's lots of people are going to mention the heroes of this campaign, obviously Simon and Tickle. I think we just not forget the people without whom none of this would have happened, and that is, of course, the British Chiropractic Association.
Now here's one of the libel heroes, Simon Singh, expressing his thanks for the support he received 4 years ago, right up to today.
Thank you also to everybody who was there 4 years ago, because personally, I was on the point of buckling, and I could easily have caved in, but the support and the confidence and the courage you gave me meant I carried on fighting. And then beyond my just my case, you were the guys that turned this into a proper campaign. You left this building and you spoke to people face to face, you tweeted about this, you blogged about it, and people began to take an interest in this kind of a niche area of libel and libel reform. And it wasn't just a national issue that you turned it into, but an international issue. I've been to Canada and America and India and New Zealand and Australia, Germany, Norway, and I've met people who heard about the campaign and who supported it from afar. And not only supported it from afar, but also admired what you've achieved, because what you've actually achieved is taken an issue like libel reform and actually made a historic change. People have been fighting for this change for 100 years, and you've actually achieved it. So well done to everybody.
Chris French, who was back in the Pendrell's Oak 4 years ago, reminisces about what it was like to be there and where the first funding for the campaign may have come from.
The one thing that I most remember from that evening, I mean, and I've heard that, you know, Simon has said that he wasn't even sure that people would bother turning up. And we We came here that night and this place was absolutely jam-packed. And there was a definite, really palpable sense that people would not allow this to just stand. People were going to fight about this. And I recall that before I came out, when my daughter, my youngest daughter, who was 13 at the time, she'd actually asked me where I was going, and I told her, and she said, "Well, you know, what might you do?" And I said, "Oh, I really don't know. You know, maybe we'll set up a fighting fund or something like this." And so she gave me £1, which during the course of the evening I was able to pass on to Simon. I don't know how useful it was, but you know, I'm sure it made that little bit of difference. But it was just an indication of, say, the strength of feeling that there was, that we really had to do something about this.
Here's Hardeep Singh reminding us why we had to fight this campaign in the first place.
My involvement in the campaign started in 2010, a few months prior to my trial. I was sued by a holy man from the Punjab, 4,000 miles away, and I'd written an article for a sort of English newspaper and described him as a cult leader. Obviously, you know, being 4,000 miles away and never having stepped foot in Britain, nor reading, writing, or speaking any English, was clearly no obstacle for suing in Britain.
Brian Cox talks about the scrappy coalition that made the campaign and the impact it has had.
As I said, I think I remember 4 years ago at the time, that what you must remember about Simon is he's not only a campaigner, but he took an enormous personal and financial risk to fight for what was right. And I think probably one of the most valuable things I think that's come out of this, other than, of course, the partial victory in terms of the library reform, but as I think Rob said, there's much more work to be done, is that we can be a campaigning movement that has an effect. And I think this coalition of reasonable, rational people has shown that it can be listened to in Parliament, and I hope we'll continue to stay together, crystallising around Sense About Science and other organisations, so that we can forward this agenda, which shouldn't really be an agenda. It amazes me that the rational thought should be a niche activity that needs a campaign such as this to push forward, but I think that is absolutely true. So I think the success is on many levels, although I suppose has been emphasised, it's a partial success in terms of libel reform, but it has turned us into a campaigning force. It's ruffled wonderful feathers. I noticed that there was this article by Brendan O'Neill in The Telegraph having a go at Simon and other things, and I think that's a sign of absolute success.
Here's Nick Cohn explaining the not-so-British reaction to the whole campaign back at the beginning.
4 years ago, I had a speech. I don't know how many of you have spoken before British audiences. You can outline actually scandalous situations, which the libel law in Britain was. You could outline the international shame of how legal profession has made Britain a kind of global brothel where pimps and clients come from all over the world. You can lay it all on as thick as you like. At the end of it, your classic British audience will go tut-tut, shake their head and then say, "But what can we do?" The difference here 4 years ago was, I was fully expecting that reaction, was this room turned into a raging sea of geeks, of furious, angry, spouting geeks. You were terrifying to watch, ladies and gentlemen. Your spectacles actually missed up. And I am...
Dara O'Brien tells us how the libel campaign made him feel all grown up.
I am enormously happy that this has passed through for no other reason than the reasons given is that finally we can speak the truth of how we really feel about Simon Singh. That the notoriously litigious Singh will set on us that team of lawyers that he's had at his beck and call for the last few years. His oppressive days are over. It has been an enormously interesting process to be involved with. I'll be honest to you, because the world I'm involved in is obviously one in which you expect silently people to be going, and the presumption I've got large clown shoes. There was no point during any of the things, those speeches from the middle band, or any time we're doing Channel 4 News, or any of these other things that you asked me to do, that I didn't on the inside go, "Fuck me, this is very grown up."
To finish off, where are we now with libel? Evan Harris sums up the act.
We've got a higher threshold of harm, which we need to bring as an early test, and it's not quite there yet, but it's something there. We've got liberalisation of the law of what used to be called fair comment, which is now honest opinion, and more liberal. There is a public interest defence, which might be more liberal. It's certainly in the next few years going to cost a lot of money to run that defence, but that's, you know, hopefully there'll be a wealthy defendant coming along to do that. There is the single publication rule, which has been talked about earlier, which is critical. There's my own small contribution, which is a privilege for peer review publications, which should at least reduce the insurance costs of some medical journals. There's the ability now for judges to make early decisions on matters that used to be left to juries, and there's provision against, not libel tourism, but libel kidnap, because Nick Cohen, with whom it's a pleasure to agree with 90% of what he said this evening, first time in a long time. As Nick Cohen's pointed out, the problem of libel tourism may still exist, but libel kidnap, where we disgracefully grab other people from other parts of the world and bring them here when it's not the right place to bring them, has gone. Now, those are all achievements, but there is a lot to do.
There are loads of other speakers, from Peter Wilmshurst, Rob Flellow, Justine Roberts from Mumsnet, and Richard Dunstan, to name a few. Not to mention much more from the speakers you've heard. But you had to be there, man! It was pretty much the calmest, nerdiest Woodstock ever. Well, one that could be held in a pub, anyway. This has been Liz Luchtendorf for The Pod Delusion.
Now, many people will be familiar with the work of comedian Robin Ince, who over the last few years has made selling out huge theatres with shows about science into a thing that actually happens. Last week, Robin unveiled a logical extension of this, taking all of the people from these variety nights and putting them into an iPad app. To find out more, the other day we caught up with Robin and the app's producer and friend of the show, Trent Burton. We're here with Dr. Robin Ince and Trent Burton, who are the brains behind the incomplete map of the cosmic genome. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, I've yet again dreamt up a title that kind of possibly says nothing whatsoever, but we'll have lots of people wondering what it was. Like with Infinite Monkey Cage, it was, you know, for the first 3 months, or first three series that we did that, people go, what does it mean? What does Infinite Monkey Cage mean? You think, well, actually, it was just a kind of a rhythm of words with a possible meaning. That was all. Declaring openly in the title that science is and always will be, certainly in any form of foreseeable future, to be incomplete. That it is a journey through, as I always say, you know, it's a journey to constantly find the least wrong answers. And each time we find a less wrong answer, then people journey to find one that's slightly less wrong than that.
Let our audience know sort of what that actually is. It's an app for iPads, and I mean, I don't want to make it sound rude, but you don't come across the most technologically savvy person, Robin. How did it all happen?
It's very similar, really, to... I remember with Alan Moore once, when there was talk of Dodgem Logic, a magazine that he put together, which I used to write in it, and Josie Long and many others. And Alan said, oh, they'll show me Apple are quite interested in doing a Dodgem Logic thing. And I thought, Alan, interested in this? And then he kind of looked and he went, it's, you know, keep it to paper. But this was originally going to be a documentary idea. And then I realised if the documentary idea was good enough and the BBC wanted to make it, then they wouldn't make it with me. They'd just steal it and make it with someone else. And so I thought the better thing to do, really, was do nothing. And then Trent said, why not turn it into an app? I like the ideas of app. I don't really have time. I mean, you know, in terms of modern things, I am now playing Star Wars Angry Birds, and I've done quite well on the levels so far. But I just decided that when Trent suggested that, I thought that is a really great idea. So we just got together, worked out how much money we'd lose together if no one was interested, and just started interviewing everyone that I could find who was a scientist or interested in science. And very quickly we realised that, you know, even if this fails, we will have built up an enormous library of interviews with some very interesting scientists, science writers, and that kind of thing. So whatever happens, even if financially and commercially it's a disaster, I think we will have built up a very interesting collection of interviews, which are not the archetypal interviews that a lot of the scientists would probably go through in the mass media, and indeed a lot longer on the ideas than the mass media would want. So when you get to things about the LHC, to actually give someone 15 minutes to describe where we've got to so far is not something you'd get in the soundbite culture.
So Trent, talk us through how the app actually works. I guess it's a bit like Encarta.
Let me tell you. I can't.
It's basically, the way I've described it is, if you remember when you were a kid and you had Encarta and how awesome Encarta was when you first got it, it's kind of like that. So there's a massive periodic table that over time will fill up and fill up and fill up with all different people, and you can go into, if you tap Brian Cox, for instance, you'll go to his profile page, you'll get a little bit of an interview with Brian about whatever he's talking about, huge transcript of the interview, and then every month there'll be special topics as well. So whether that's Steve Jones going on about the pleasure he gets from looking at snails for 55 years or whatever it is. And then each month there'll be new updates. So it kind of links to what Robin was saying about being the least wrong as well. If something changes, if they find it's not a Higgs boson, it's something else, we can release another bit and go, see, we're still the least wrong because we don't have a finite timeline, really.
Excellent. And it's all operating on a rather modern subscription model.
Yeah, so when you buy it initially, you'll get a big chunk of content in it. So it's about 3-4 months worth of stuff in it, and then a 3-month subscription included, so you can try it out. Mm. And then you can buy a subscription, which is much less than going to one movie, and you get a whole year's worth of content. So each month you'll get all the new videos and articles and blah, 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 blah.
When is it all going to be available? Because it was announced yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to make something very clear, by the way. When we put up the teaser trailer, a teaser trailer is not all of the content, because someone said, that seems really expensive, because basically the teaser trailer is just, you know, Richard Dawkins saying something and Steve Jones and Helen Zersky and Helen Keane and whatever. And someone said, I presumed that we were merely making an app where you could watch a scientist say one sentence. And then another scientist say another sentence. They hadn't realised that teaser trailer is not the... As you actually, I think, tweeted it, you know, Iron Man 3, it was rubbish. It was 2.5 minutes long and nothing was tied up. But, so we've started... And also, it's going to be interesting to get the feedback, because the idea is that it will be a library of when the LHC, when an idea of epigenetics, when... you know, MMR or other vaccination ideas are in the news, that you can go on and you can see Ben Goldacre talking about when you can try and work out whether a vaccine, you know, the kind of how panic is created in the media and how to best find a cure or at least an understanding of why people think like that. So with luck as well, we will constantly, not just with luck actually, with judgment as well and forethought. In fact, luck has nothing to do with that. That's a very unscientific thing for me to say. That there will constantly be these different things where you think, oh, I wonder what that's all about.
And I guess finally then, do you want to name drop who's going to be in the app?
Do you know what? I don't know if we've even fully decided who's going to be in the first one, but I mean, we have very long interviews with, you know, with Richard Dawkins, with Brian Cox, with Steve Jones, with Helen Zersky, with Helen Keane, with all of the Festival of the Spoken Nerd, with Lawrence Krauss. And we're doing more at the moment. We'll be doing some more tonight as well. So one of the things, you know, we're very conscious of as well is to make sure that it is not a very male science app as well. You know, we're always conscious of the fact that we want to, you know, science is you know, constantly changing, and indeed people who, you know, there was a while where people would possibly you know, it was seen as science was, you know, it's for male geeks. And as we know, you know, we're looking at the audiences that come to a lot of the shows that I do and a lot of the shows that I, when I go and visit other people, is that was a ridiculous notion. And so that's another thing we're very aware of, is we want to make sure that there are as many representatives, that it doesn't fall into any of the cliches.
Excellent.
And something also, I think, we're not announcing who's in each month. It's kind of a bit like a Top Trumps or a trading card thing, that each month when you get to the update day, you don't know who you're going to get. You might, because Richard Dawkins is in the trailer, he may or may not be in the first month. So every time you update the app, you're not going to know who you're going to get. You might get a physicist, you might get a biologist that you've never heard of before.
But I think there will always be enough of that. I mean, for the amount of stuff we've got, I hope there will always be a broad, you know, we'll be covering lots of different disciplines. You know, you're never going to go, oh, it's all physics again. And that's another thing that, you know, we want to broaden out further and further in terms of, you know, philosophers and writers and other people's opinions, like talking to Christopher Sykes today, who made pleasure of finding things out, the X and Richard Feynman documentary. And, you know, so now getting, you know, the angles from other sides as well of people who've been involved in science, or indeed merely people who are interested in science.
One of the things that we've managed to do that I really like is it's not just the name. It's not just the Dawkinses and the Coxes and stuff. We've got some of the people who are doing PhDs here at UCL building plasma microscopes in Antarctica, who you're not going to know the guy's name, but he's just doing amazing new science, and actually giving him an audience for this kind of stuff they're doing, I think, is really good.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's definitely not just about, you know, fame. It is about working scientists as well.
Yeah.
And it's about trying to get as much of an idea of that. And hopefully as well, something else that we want to start pretty soon is we want to get school children to nominate their science teacher who they think, if they've got someone they think is a really great science teacher, whether it is merely because they keep losing their eyebrows in, you know, incredibly ridiculous chemistry experiments, or merely just because they excite them a great deal about, you know, the lifespan of a locust or what go on in subatomic particles. We're going to start having a kind of teacher of the month as well.
And before one of the Pod Delusion nerd listeners tells me it's not a plasma microscope, it's a neutrino microscope. I've just remembered someone will pick me up on that. I know, but I've remembered in time. It's okay.
So we'll put links to the app when it's available in early June, isn't it?
Yeah, around the time of Cheltenham Science Festival, it'll be out.
Trent, Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, whilst it may soon be possible for gay people to marry in this country, the same is not true for humanists. Through some quirk in the law, despite being legal in Scotland, humanist marriage ceremonies in England and Wales are not legally binding. So if you want to wed in unholy matrimony, then the only option at present is to do a civil wedding in a registry office. The British Humanist Association don't think this is really on, and in this next piece, Blakely Nixon has been speaking to their head of public affairs, Pavan Dhaliwal, to explain what they want people to do to try and get the law changed.
So this is Blakely Nixon for the Pod Delusion, and I'm here with Pavan Dhaliwal, who's the head of public affairs at the British Humanist Association. So Pavan, you're here to talk about humanist marriage. So what have we been doing in Parliament with regards to humanist marriage?
Well, Blakely, what we've been doing is trying to legalise humanist marriage. There is no legal recognition of humanist marriages in England and Wales at the moment. They are legal in Scotland and the Republic of Ireland and many other countries.
And the attempts in Parliament are to make them legally recognised as a church wedding would be?
Yes. So basically, there is a very simple amendment down to the same-sex marriage bill, which would give legal recognition to humanist marriages. And that's what we're trying to have passed through Parliament at the moment.
Okay. So what kind of support have we got in Parliament for this amendment?
Well, the amendment has actually been tabled by 7 MPs, and it's a cross-party amendment. So that shows that we do have cross-party support. But this is despite the fact that the government have recently come out to say that they won't be supporting the amendment.
What is their explanation for not supporting the amendment?
Well, actually, there is no clear explanation. There's been a lot of scaremongering and factual inaccuracies put out to the media by the government about our amendment, most recently of which was that our amendment would allow Jedi Knights to get married legally, which, of course, that's not what our amendment would be doing. As I've assured all MPs who will be voting on Monday and Tuesday as well, is that what the government have tried to say is that the amendment would leave the government open to legal challenge from fringe religious groups or pagans or Satanists. This is from their statement that they put out, to legal action if they only allow us to have legal marriages and not them. That's not true at all. Those groups could take legal action now. And so we're not in any way increasing the scope of them taking legal action should humanist marriage be legally recognised here.
So what can Pod Delusioners do to help?
Well, what's really important and what we would really appreciate is if people would go to our the BHA Facebook page and click through to our Take Action, which basically takes 2 clicks. Enter your name and postcode and a letter will go automatically to your MP urging them to vote in favour of the amendment on Monday. We need to get a majority vote for this amendment to pass. If we don't, it's going to make it very, very difficult. And marriage reform comes about every 10 or 20 years. So this really is a bit of a last chance saloon for us to get this legal recognition.
Okay, and I'll get James to put any links on the Pod Delusion website. Thank you very much, Pavan.
Thank you.
Now, on this week 40 years ago, the big news was that homosexuality was declassified by the American Psychiatric Association from being a mental illness into something that's normal. Surely, given this march of progress since then, we're now only a short time away from the world recognising gay marriage as a legitimate activity, and hopefully reclassifying libertarianism as a temporary mania experienced when not having thought properly about things. To explain more about the anniversary, here's Chris Chapman.
This month marks the 40th anniversary of a pivotal moment in both psychiatry and gay rights. 40 years ago, if you were homosexual, you'd have been considered mentally unwell. It was a pathology of the mind. But in May 1973, a chance encounter in a Honolulu bar ended all of this. It convinced one of the few men that could remove the diagnosis that it was the right thing to do so, and resulted in December that year of homosexuality being stricken from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. the DSM, the Bible of Mental Health. Homosexuality had, at that point, been considered a disease for about 100 years. Despite work from, among others, Freud and Kinsey, it was widely held that it should be included in the DSM. Now, this had a profound effect on homosexuals. For starters, they weren't allowed to practice as psychiatrists. You don't let someone with a pathological disorder practice medicine. As such, they were at risk of losing their medical license if they came out, and so change from inside the organisation was tough. But it's important to point out that psychiatrists aren't the bad guys here. They believed they were helping their patients, just as they would help someone with schizophrenia or depression. Anyway, back to the story. There was a strong LGBT political movement in the late 60s and early 70s. They didn't want to be considered mentally ill. They wanted to be considered equals. The movement wasn't having much impact, though, in psychiatry. Medicine was above politics, after all, and medicine said homosexuality was a pathology. But things were beginning to change. This is best highlighted by an event in 1972, when one particularly brave individual agreed to speak out. His name was Dr. John Fryer, a gay psychiatrist who found himself blackballed because of his sexuality. He agreed to address the American Psychiatric Association, the Guardians of the DSM, as Dr. Anonymous. He wore an oversized suit, a silly wig, and a Richard Nixon mask, using a voice-changing microphone to disguise his identity. He explained just how harmful the definition was to him, the impact it had had on his career, and by the end of the talk, he was given a standing ovation. Strangely enough, in the front row was the very person who had fired him after he revealed his sexuality. Now, this shows the strong undercurrent of how things were beginning to shift. Dr. Fryer was one of several homosexual psychiatrists who were known as members of an informal group called the Gay PA. But even this group of psychiatrists thought that homosexuality was a medical condition, a pathology. They just believed that they suffered from it. The real change came from the strangest of places, a heckler. Dr. Robert Spitzer, on the nomenclature subcommittee of the APA, was giving a speech. He was interrupted mid-flow by a gay activist called Ron Gold. A bit annoyed, after the speech was concluded, Spitzer headed over to Gold to confront him and complain. But the two men got talking. Spitzer believed in the traditional psychiatric model, that homosexuality was a mental illness. But he agreed that, at the next nomenclature subcommittee meeting, at the May 1973 Honolulu Convention of the APA, they would discuss once and for all whether homosexuality should be a diagnosis. Unsurprisingly, this was a packed event. A debate between the traditional approach and psychiatrists and Ron Gold, who believed the diagnosis should be quashed. The activist won convincingly, but it wasn't enough. According to Alex Spiegel's outstanding documentary on the subject, 81 Words, the real battle happened in a bar that night. Ron Gold was invited to a secret gay PA party to celebrate. As his plus one, he decided to invite Robert Spitzer. Now, Spitzer was a heterosexual, and he found it mind-blowing. He found himself in a room full of colleagues he never knew were gay. He was quickly uncovered, mainly due to asking some inappropriate questions, and the gay PA urged Ron Gold to get Spitzer out of the room. Now, history could have gone a different path here, but at this point, serendipity struck. A young military psychiatrist walked into the bar, in full dress uniform, overwhelmed by what had taken place earlier in that day. Ignoring everyone, he walked straight up to Gold and broke into tears, hugging him. Now, this had a profound effect on Spitzer. He realised the importance of making right the diagnosis. At once, he went up to his room and drafted a change which would finally become part of the DSM in December 1973. The words say it all. It was under sexual orientation disturbance, brackets homosexuality, number 302.0. Homosexuality by itself does not constitute a psychiatric disorder. Homosexuality per se is one form of sexual behaviour and, like other forms of sexual behaviour which are not by themselves psychiatric disorders, it is not listed in this nomenclature of mental disorders. The diagnosis had been quashed. Homosexuality was no longer a disease. Now, this isn't the end of the tale. There was an attempt to shoot down this new definition in its infancy, but it failed. And even today, this is still a bit of a hot potato, with arguments that the change was more political and less scientific. But that's for another time. If you want to find out more information, I heartily recommend the wonderful episode 81 Words of This American Life by Alex Spiegel. It's a far more in-depth look at the story behind the diagnosis, and there's a link to it on the Poddelusion website. This has been Chris Chapman reporting for the Poddelusion. And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. Also on our website, you can listen to over 3.5 years worth of podcast archives and much, much more. And whilst there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations help us pay the server bills and all that sort of thing, so we really do appreciate them. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Michael Marshall, Sean Ellis, Liz Lutgendorf, Blakely Nixon, Chris Chapman, Max Davey, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Come in, come in. Take the weight off your feet.
So, this is the inner sanctum of number 10, is it? Oh, very nice.
Well, it's a place to hang one's hat.
And this is where Cobra meets, is it?
Oh, no, no. We book a stateroom for that. And her name's Angela, by the way. Anyway, you know why we've been called here.
Europe?
Yes.
Well, you'll need to speak to the Prime Minister about it. We need a referendum now. In or out?
Well, that's easier said than done. Do you have any idea how hard it is to get everyone singing from the same hymn sheet? Anyhow, the PM wants to be involved. He doesn't want to feel left out when his Euro chums get together for drinkies.
But he's operating on a mandate from the majority.
Not really. That's why we got a coalition in the first place, you see. He just wants to maintain the status quo.
Yes, but the polls are saying...
Who cares about the polls? Just a lot of noise, and we're not bothered by Ladbrokes offering 70-1 odds against a successful outcome to the campaign either.
Now, why does he want to stay in at any cost?
Look, the PM studies history. You should have heard him last night, pacing up and down, ranting on about Waterloo.
Waterloo?
Yes. And then he threw a right paddy, as it were, shouting, why do the Irish always do so well?
The Irish? Oh, hang on, hang on. The PM does know the difference between Eurovision and the European Union, doesn't he?
Ah. Nil point, Dave. Nil point.